And now, Christ in Pop Culture presents Persuasion with Aaron Straza and Hannah Anderson. Hello, everyone. I'm Aaron Straza, and with me is Hannah Anderson. We're your hosts for Persuasion, the place where fine ladies, rational minds, and the best kind of company gather to discuss all sorts of ideas and issues. Today's conversation is part of our summer mini-series called Showing Up. Each episode, we are exploring a different aspect of what it means to be faithfully present in our current day. In our last episode, we talked about curiosity and being open in these difficult, sometimes difficult relationships where there are divides. And Hannah, I so enjoyed that conversation with Rachel. And again, super challenging, been thinking about how I can connect with people in these ways as she modeled and explained.
You know, I had the same response. And part of what I took away from our conversation with Rachel was that she was crossing massive divides culturally, religiously, ethnically, culturally. And it kind of put the divides that I'm struggling with in a bit of perspective, that it does feel very large and serious, but also there's a lot that we can use to bridge these divides that we're feeling even within our own culture, maybe even within our own families and churches, that there is shared perspective to a degree, and we can kind of lean into that.
I appreciated the focus on finding those places where you are similar and where you can share life. I thought that seemed very hopeful, and there was such a curiosity element there that I thought was so important of, tell me this about how you live and how you think. And I think that that is something that we've talked about quite a bit over the years on Persuasion. How do we have good conversations? How do we learn how other people think? And that helps sharpen our own thinking and our own beliefs.
It absolutely does. At the same time, though, part of good conversation means recognizing where differences do exist. Like, we can be open and we can be curious and we can kind of engage each other from our different places and have this hospitality within our conversations. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, there are going to be differences, and there has to be a way for us to carefully and charitably communicate, well, actually, I think something different than you do about that. And it doesn't have to be a threat, but I still want to be known. And part of being vulnerable means being able to say what I actually think in a way that maybe can be received or at least acknowledged that there is a difference.
I wonder if that's where so much conversational and relational angst comes from in terms of these differences and divides, because you want to show up with your whole self, but you're not quite sure, how do I share that I think something different? But really, that's something that we can grow in and we can learn about and make it maybe at least not quite so scary and not quite so angsty if we can learn better ways of communicating. Recently, we connected with Rebecca McLaughlin about how to communicate our beliefs with clarity and thoughtfulness. Rebecca, we are so thrilled that you could spend time with us today at Persuasion. Welcome.
Thank you.
We're so thrilled you're here. Well, we want to make sure that everyone who's listening knows a bit about you. So could you just share a bit about yourself? And really, I'd love to know how you made your way from the UK to the US. Just tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, well, how I made my way from the UK to the US was by marrying a guy from Oklahoma.
But I'll give that you the would
slight
do it.
Story. Yeah, so I come from the UK, grew up there, and honestly never had any desire to leave, partly because I love my homeland, and partly because the lack of gospel resourcing in the UK, at least compared to the US, is far less there than there is here. So as someone who is passionate about telling people about Jesus and having people grow in discipleship and apologetics and all these good things, the last thing I would have thought of was moving to the US. But the Lord has a sense of humor, I think. Yeah, Brian and I met right at the end of my PhD in English literature and middle of his PhD in engineering. And about all we have in common is those first three letters of the subjects that we've studied. And I was headed off to seminary, funnily enough. We dated for a couple of years and then got married, and he was very keen to move to the US. I feel like I'm continually meeting Americans who say they wish they lived in England.
Yes.
And I married the one American who really didn't want to live in England. So my thinking was that he really was not happy in England. We should at least see if I would be unhappy in America. And his view was, it's hard being American in England, but if you're English in America, people really like you. So
this
it was
true.
Really better. All that being said, God moves in mysterious ways. And yeah, we've been here for 13 years, around 13 years. And it's been remarkable. I've had incredible opportunities to, for many years, to work with Christian professors at leading secular universities, places like Harvard and MIT and Yale and Oxford and Cambridge, and to both help them with how they communicate their faith in relationship with their work, but more importantly, actually learn from them about how they integrate their faith with their work. And after 9 years of doing that, talking with world leaders in philosophy to psychology to history, I felt like I had a bit of a roadmap of where the questions are and where the conversations are at the academic level when it comes to Christianity and all these different disciplines. And so I wrote a book called Confronting Christianity to try and share that roadmap with with other people, and just to expose people to some of the extraordinary Christian scholars who God has raised up in all of these fields, who are literally world-class experts in sorts of things that are supposed to have discredited or disproved the Christian faith, but actually are also very serious followers of Jesus.
Rebecca, there's two things that stick out to me in what you just shared. Number one, I do want to affirm that it's easier, more than likely easier, to be British in the United States. You have instant credibility just because of your accent. It's the most ridiculous thing, but we just think by listening to you that you are automatically smarter regardless of whether you have a PhD or not. So we will believe you when you say things in a British accent.
This I found, although I will say, whereas my IQ gets an unfair bump moving to the US, my the extent to which I'm funny decreases because humor depends on knowing exactly where the cultural line is and sort of cutting it slightly, or the specific pronunciation of a word or meaning of a word in a particular context. I'll make really funny jokes over here and people just look at me like, that word doesn't exist here, or you don't pronounce it that way, or whatever it is. Anyway, I'm only slightly resentful. But carry on, Hannah. You were going to say something?
Yes. The other thing that catches my attention is you said you are passionate about sharing your faith and sharing Jesus with people. And honestly, I think that that is something that a lot of people struggle with, and they long for, and they maybe envy, but there's this kind of hesitance, this reticence of being fully themselves in what they love in front of their neighbors or their relatives even. And there's this kind of holding back of things that we believe, things that we profess and claim to be true, but we're just not quite sure how to be open or vulnerable or passionate about them. So that's why I particularly think that your work is giving us a bit, as you mentioned, a roadmap through your own process to do that. And it seems to me that apologetics isn't simply about convincing other people so much as giving us the confidence to live openly with our faith.
Yeah, and when I say I'm passionate, I don't mean I'm not scared. This is something that I have to talk with my girls about. I've got two daughters who are just 11 and nearly 9, and then a son who's nearly 3. He's quite level yet, but the 9 and 11-year-old. they're already having hard conversations with friends at school, where they're bumping up against the ways in which Christianity to their friends is not just sort of strange and deluded, but actually offensive and immoral. And one of the things that I've been saying to them is, hey, these conversations are only going to get worse over the coming years as you get older. And the fact that you find it hard and upsetting and that it feels vulnerable is not evidence that you're doing it wrong, or that, you know, it's not evidence of anything bad necessarily. I feel that way too. And I think one of the things that helped me when I was a college student, I mean, funnily enough, for the last more than a decade in my life, I actually have no choice but to tell somebody when I first meet them that I'm a Christian, because they ask what I do, and there's like really no way to explain it without saying that. But before I was in any kind of sort of professional Christian ministry, I used to try and just introduce the fact that I was a Christian in the very first conversation so that I wouldn't chicken out later. You know, it's always easy, I think, to think, you know, one day when I know this person really well, when we have, you know, gone on family vacations together, then I'll mention the fact that I'm a follower of Jesus and I think the life is only found in him. I'm not saying that that's never the right approach, but for me, I'm instinctively a bit empowered, actually. So in some ways, it's been easier for me to just introduce that right from the get-go and have conversations on that basis, rather than sort of wondering if one day I can slip this in sometime.
I appreciate that you are acknowledging the emotional factor that comes with having open conversations about faith, because, like you said, just because you're passionate doesn't mean that you aren't fearful. And I think that there's a presumption that we will someday get to the point where there's zero care, concern, fear that what we say may not be received well. And so if we're waiting for the day that we don't feel uncomfortable with those feelings and the concern, we will never get there and these conversations would never happen. So do you have any sense of becoming more comfortable in it? Like, is there anything that has improved in terms of your conversations over the years as you've moved forward despite the fear that you have?
Yeah, I think one of the tricky things that we have to navigate, and I think this is especially true in our particular cultural context today, is that some of the reasons, in fact, many of the reasons that our non-Christian friends or family members will have for thinking that Christianity is evil and offensive and wrong are actually really good reasons. So that there'll be an extent to which we may have friends who, for example, are passionate believers in human equality and who feel heartbroken and outraged by the way that Black people have been treated over the centuries in this country, and especially in the time of slavery and segregation, but even subsequently as well. And they will have seen white Christians being very complicit in this. And so they will have a hostility toward us saying, especially if we are like me, if you're a white person who's also an evangelical, they'll have an instinctive hostility to us and to the message that we're bringing. It's actually founded on something that's completely right, which is horror and disgust at racial oppression and the evil of racism, essentially. And that's not them hating Christianity. That's them hating the sins of Christians over the years. And so I think it's helpful for me, as I've learned more and studied more, both in terms of scriptures and in terms of history, to be able to pinpoint, okay, here are the things that actually my friends are right about, and I need to fully acknowledge that they're right. Being kind of defensive of my tribe is not actually defending Jesus at all. It's in fact just defending my tribe and the sins of my tribe. But at the same time, as I've studied more in the scriptures and as I've learned more about history and current sociology, once you realize that actually the most typical Christian in America today is a black woman, person, the kind of person demographically most likely to be a very serious follower of Jesus, who goes to church every week, reads the Bible, prays, and holds to, you know, core evangelical beliefs, whether or not that label would be used, is actually a black woman. That then just changes the framework of the conversation somewhat. So I think what's been helpful to me has been, you know, with a number of issues, working through, okay, what are the things that my friends hate that they actually rightly should hate? And that actually it's on the basis of Christian ethics that they should hate those things. But, you know, where do I need to appropriately acknowledge the sins of my own tribe? And where can I also give them information that will help them to see that this is something not that ultimately should point them away from Jesus?
And to me, it's these hot button issues that, you know, are dividing us as communities, families, as a nation, that make it really hard to navigate questions of faith. Because as you said, Rebecca, so often Christians and the established church has failed at these conversations and in very real ways that can be, we can point to. And, you know, I think that's what's so helpful about your work, and particularly your latest book, The Secular Creed, where you really get into the weeds a bit with these conversations, whether it's race or sexuality. In my experience, it's these questions that keep me from wanting to talk about my Christianity, because I'm very happy to talk to them about, you know, a God who is just or a God who loves them. But it's the cultural kind of atmosphere around these hot button issues that make it really hard.
Yeah, and I think that's especially true when it comes to questions of sexuality and gender. And what's happening, one of the main things I'm trying to do in The Secular Creed is actually help people, help Christians disentangle questions of racial justice and equality on the one hand from questions of sexual identity and gender identity on the other, and sort of diagnose how they've all got tangled up in the first place, which, you know, the bottom line is actually Christian sin. But because when we look at the Bible, it actually points us in completely opposite directions when it comes to racial justice and equality on the one hand, strongly affirms and is actually the basis for our belief in universal equality, regardless of race or nationality. So it pulls us in a completely one direction when it comes to racial diversity and love across racial difference. It actually points us a completely different direction when it comes to affirming, for example, same-sex marriage or a gender identity that's different than that we were born with. And so I think one of the things that we need to do for ourselves, but also as we enter into conversation with friends who don't share our beliefs, is actually be able to disentangle these two things, to see how historically they've been tangled up, to see what the Bible actually says about all of these issues, and then to be able to present a sort of gospel-centered, Jesus-rich vision of why we believe what we believe, and actually how much is lost if we pull the Christian foundations out. Because I think for many of our friends today, they think that belief in universal human equality, belief that men and women are fundamentally morally equal, belief that the historically oppressed should be protected and not trampled, et cetera, all these things, they think that they're just self-evident truths. You don't need any kind of particular religious foundation for believing any of this stuff. In fact, you're probably better off without one. Actually, if you look both historically and if you look at what even non-Christian historians and philosophers are saying today, you'll quickly realize that these are all specifically Christian beliefs, and that if we pull Christianity out of the foundation, we don't get a better moral foundation for universal equality and love across racial difference, etc., etc. We actually get a moral abyss.
This episode is brought to you in part by Beyond Ordinary Women Ministries, which prepares Christian women for leadership. At BOW, we believe that every woman is a leader because she influences someone. So, whom do you influence? Do you mentor a woman, serve in the workplace, or do you lead a small group, teach the Bible, or even lead an entire ministry? No matter who or how many you influence, our free online resources will help equip you. Our videos, podcast episodes, and articles from experienced women leaders will encourage you and perfect your leadership skills. They offer wisdom for dealing with ministry pitfalls, current biblical issues, health for your own soul, and insights for shepherding others well. In addition, BOW offers Bible studies designed to connect women of multiple generations. They provide a challenge to both women new to the Bible and those wanting to dig deeper. Be our guest and browse all of our free resources and low-cost Bible studies at beyondordinarywomen.org.
Something that's really challenging from what you're saying, Rebecca, is that it seems like you are calling us to do a lot of inner work that maybe we haven't taken the time to do. You mentioned disentangling these ideas even within our own minds. And I think about the lack of time that I have spent specifically on, have I worked through these things in my own mind and heart? And I may have a sense of where I land on these things, but I have to admit, it's not as if I have it so sorted out that I feel ready to have these kinds of conversations, which is why I would tend to shy away. And so the challenge to basically dig in and do the work, I think that's a good one. And I feel challenged in a good way from what you're saying here about doing the needed thought process that would allow me to be ready for these conversations.
Yeah, and to be clear, when I talk about doing that work, I'm personally really not an expert on anything. I have a PhD in prisons and Shakespeare, which nobody's asking me to speak about, funnily enough, and which, frankly, I've forgotten most of what I ever knew. What I do is I figure out who the experts are, and then I try to learn from them. And I try to learn from them, actually, whether they're Christians or not. When I'm trying to get a handle on the truth of the situation as far as I can, one of the first things I'll do is go and look at what do people who are frankly hostile to my position say about this. And so, like, let's listen to the atheists, let's listen to the agnostics, let's listen to people who not have a ideological motivation for agreeing with me on this issue, and see what they're saying. Then I'll look at what some leading Christian experts are saying and try to find actual experts rather than people who just, you know, have to talk about something, whether or not they have an expertise. And there you'll find, okay, so there's some overlap, in fact, between what the atheist is saying and what the Christian academic is saying. So that's probably, you can be confident about where they overlap. They're both saying the same thing, you know, and then you can see the differences. But the reality is none of us has the time to become an expert in every relevant field. And there's almost a move that's being made at the moment in some circles to say, you know, the sort of do your research approach, which says, don't trust those experts out there, do your own research. And I'm thinking, well, the vast majority of us have neither the time nor the training, any valid research in any of the fields that we might be wanting to look at. So what we're much better to do is find accredited experts and learn from their research. And what I try to do in my writing is sort of just take that one step further to say, okay, I've done the work of finding those experts and harvesting their research. And then I've tried to sort of package it in a way that would enable you to sit down with something like the Secular Creed and with your Bible open, actually, and to look and say, okay, is this lining up with what the Bible says? Because if it's not, it's junk. But if it is, then that hopefully will help you to get to the point where you've worked through some of these issues for yourself and are able to talk to a friend, but without you having to kind of quite do the research.
And I love that in that you're modeling something for us. You're modeling a way of listening and gathering information before just landing on a position. And, you know, being a product of American evangelicalism and having grown up here, I can tell you that it is a vastly different engagement with these kind of cultural issues. We tend to be more politically motivated in some ways toward getting the right position and making sure we stand for that position within the broader culture that we witness for that position. And there's not as much attention given to how do we get to that position? how do we go through the process? And so I think it's fascinating that, you know, coming in from outside, you also are a little freer than the rest of us because we have a level of baggage, to be just quite frank, a level of angst. And folks I know that want to more thoughtfully engage these questions, at least within American evangelicalism, have to first distance themselves from what we would term the culture wars, but at the risk of leaving the conversation altogether. And there's not a viable way forward to say, you know, I can stay in this conversation. I'm just going to change the way that I'm in it.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the reasons that I wrote the Secular Creed was actually that, you know, those yard signs that, at least are in my neighborhood, maybe in yours as well, that say things like, you know, in this house, we believe that Black Lives Matter, love is love, women's rights are human rights. And then there's usually a kind of handful of other claims that, depending on the yard sign, may or may not be there. Do those exist in your parts of the world? Yeah. So people look, and I think as Christians, we look at a sign like that, and it's sort of presented to us as a package deal. And in my experience, a lot of Christians will go one of two ways. They'll either look at that and think, okay, I know that Black lives truly do matter, and that Black people have often been treated as if their lives didn't matter historically. And so, and I've been told that all these other claims kind of are wrapped up in all together. So it's sort of all you know, buy it or take it or leave it. So, you know, I'll grab that sign and I'll hammer it into my yard. Or people will take the approach of saying, well, I know that there are certain things on this sign that the Bible doesn't affirm, and so I don't want to hear any of it. I'm going to knock it down. Like, I mean, maybe not literally, but at least in my mind, I'm going to discount the whole thing. And I actually think if we're going to be truly biblical, we need to work through the claims on those yard signs with our Bibles open and see where the Bible does and doesn't agree. And actually, it's a much more complex picture that we'll come up with. Not one that lands us in any kind of new theological spaces, actually, but ones that bring us back to what the church believed from the first, which, you know, when it comes to those three claims that I mentioned, Black Lives Matter, Love is Love, and Women's Rights, Human Rights, you know, Christianity from the first was a profoundly multiracial, multi-ethnic, multicultural movement that was demanded by Jesus from the get-go. You know, literal day one of the church of Pentecost, from every tribe and tongue and nation worshiping together. When it comes to the second claim that love is love, actually Christianity was born into the Greco-Roman Empire, which was a place, at least for men, at least for sort of wealthy men, of massive sexual freedom, where it was perfectly reasonable and allowed for men to sleep with their male or female slaves, for them to sleep with women they weren't married to, for them to sleep with men they weren't married to, actually. Like, it was not a... We sometimes think they were sort of basically Victorian sexual ethics up until the 1960s, and then everything changed. But actually, Christianity was really weird in the first century for saying that sex only belongs in marriage between a man and a woman. And that sounds really weird today again, but not for the first time forever, you know. And then that third claim that women's rights are human rights, which is code for abortion rights, women's rights in this country today. From the first, Christianity was a movement against the abandonment of babies, which was, again, very common in the Greco-Roman world in the first century. And it was a movement for women's rights and equality, actually, which is why there have always been more Christian women than men. And that, as far as I can tell from research of researchers whom I've listened to, that's true across time and across space. So actually, Christianity is the foundation for women's rights being rights, not for a woman's right to have an abortion, because the same biblical motivation for believing that women are fundamentally equal to men also applies to the human dignity and equality of an unborn baby.
Yes, and I think, Rebecca, what you're describing really is a way forward for those of us who do want to show up with our faith, that we do want to live openly with our families and friends in our communities. We do want to testify to goodness, but we're coming from spaces that are so like you said, it's like a package deal. And we're almost like, well, not that one, but yes, that one. But and we really just don't have a lot of models for this kind of way of saying you can untangle these things. You can think through these things. It can be complicated. It's okay for it to be a complicated process. I'm curious, just to follow up with that, is how do you see this working out in community? Like, obviously, we read books, we tend to process on our own, but how would you like to see these conversations move forward in community, particularly now that we're trying to regather and we're trying to be together again as believers, and then taking that witness beyond the walls of the church?
Yeah. No, very helpful. I think one of the delights and privileges we have as Christians is to be part of a genuinely diverse Christian community. And when I say that, I mean diverse in all sorts of different ways. And the exact way that will look will depend on where we live. And I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we have a very diverse population, not least because people move here from all over the world. So I can sit down on Sunday at church and be next to, you know, a PhD student at MIT who grew up in China, and a Nepalese woman who's part of the Nepalese congregation that also meets in our church, who stays home with her kids, or, you know, a white woman who grew up in Florida. Like, there's just a whole lot of diversity in terms of just where people come from, their racial and ethnic national background. So I had the opportunity to learn from people's different experiences of life, depending on literally where they come from. I have the opportunity as well to learn from people's different life experiences. So I'm someone, myself, I've always been more attracted to women than to men. That's been a big kind of part of my experience, and has, you know, shaped some of the ways in which I think. But it's super helpful for me to have, like, one of my good friends at church who's a single guy who's basically exclusively attracted to men and remaining single out of devotion to the Lord, and, you know, knows what the Bible says and believes that Jesus' love is going to be better than anyone else's. But his experience of life as a single guy in his late 30s is going to be different from mine. And so there are just all sorts of opportunities, I think, even in our immediate communities, to learn from people who are different from us. And to some extent, I mean, that's language that we'll hear from our non-Christian friends sort of day in, day out. And we can, therefore, as Christians, be a little bit suspicious or skeptical of it. You know, does that mean if you're learning from people's perspective, does that mean you're relativizing truth? I don't believe there's any real absolute truth out there. Actually, I think the opposite, especially within the church, the more we learn from the diverse just life experiences of other believers, the more gloriously the ultimate and exclusive and universal truth of Jesus shines. Because he's not just true for me as a white European privileged woman who, you know, has moved to America. He's also true in Nepal, and he's also true in India, and he's also true in Africa, and he's also true for the single mother who's struggling to get by, and he's also true for the elderly man who feels lonely, and he's also true for the young child who's being foster cared for by a family in our church. So I think we actually see the uniqueness, the beauty, the universal truth of Jesus more brightly when we're truly in community with people who have very different experiences from us.
Rebecca, that is the perfect cap to this conversation. What a good word and encouragement. And we are so grateful that you would come and visit with us and share a bit about your work and, I'd say, your expertise. And I will make sure that everyone gets links to find your work and your books out on our show notes. But thank you so much for coming on to Persuasion and talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's certainly a lot for me to unpack and to continue to think about. I know there's a lot of conversation that still needs to happen around these ideas, not just with people that maybe we have differences with, but those of us who maybe share some of these common perspectives. We need to learn from each other how to communicate those well. If you are listening in and you have had experiences that have worked well for you, that you've been able to communicate well across these divides, what kinds of things would you share with us about bridging these differences without losing yourself or without losing your particular set of beliefs? We'd love for you to share that with us either on Instagram or Twitter. And to kind of sweeten the pot for that conversation, we have several copies of Rebecca's book that we're able to give away. If you will share this episode and share what ways that you have found successful or at least helpful in bridging these divides in conversation, tag us in it, and we'll enter you into a drawing for those copies of Rebecca's book, The Secular Creed. As always, you can join us in conversation in the Christ and Pop Culture Members Forum. Members gain access to that by a $5 a month donation to the work of Christ and Pop Culture, where we can support these conversations, as well as a whole slate of articles and other resources to help you navigate your living out your faith in a secular world.
Persuasion is produced by Jonathan Clausen, and it's part of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. You can find all of our shows at christandpopculture.com, or you can search for them at iTunes. Thanks so much to all of you for listening to Persuasion, and we will catch you next time.
You have been listening to Persuasion with Aaron Straza and Hannah Anderson, an official production of the Christ and Pop Culture Podcast Network. Please rate and review the show in iTunes and check out our other shows at christandpopculture.com/network. Theme music by Maiden Name.